Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. It's May 4th, 2020, live to be rebroadcast May 6th, 2020. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician with my co-host Ron Meniza. If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine while live, you can comment below on Facebook Live. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. So more coronavirus updates, of course. Don't forget to wash your hands. Cough into your elbow if you have to cough or sneeze. Don't touch your face. Stay at least 6 feet apart when you're in public and you need to physically distance from people. And if you're not feeling well, stay home. And don't forget to take your cytokine calmers. Don't forget your curcumin and ginger and nettles and resveratrol, good stuff like that. All right. So there's something that's been circulating that was sadly funny about the coronavirus, and that's that it can cause blood clots. Bad joke. All right. And so it can cause blood clots, which is kind of scary. There are doctors who are seeing complications with venous thromboembolisms. A thromboembolism means that that you're seeing a clot. A thrombus is a clot. That is when you have blood cells, we have red blood cells and platelets coming together to push blood, to cause a blockage in a blood vessel. And the reason you make a clot is because if you get a tear in a blood vessel, or if you get a tear in your skin, your blood will come to the rescue and clot to block it off. It's a normal process. But if you get a clot inside your blood vessels, when there isn't something to be blocked, it can be dangerous. And so then you can get something called an embolism. And an embolism is something that is blocking a blood vessel that shouldn't be there. It could be blocking a blood vessel, and it can also be blocking a breathing tube. So it could be blocking your bronchus. It can be blocking bronchioles. It can be blocking alveoli. So a thromboembolism is a clot that is blocking a vein, an artery, or a tube of breathing. So then there's something you can get called a DVT, or a deep venous thrombosis. Deep venous thrombosis is, so you have veins, for example, in your legs. Some of them are at the surface. And so if you get spider veins, you'll see that you have little spidery dark veins that don't seem to go away. And those are called, those are just superficial veins. And you have deep veins in your legs, such as your saphenous vein, that helps to drain the whole leg, and it's deep inside. And that's where it's concerning that if you get a blood clot there. When you get a blood clot there in the deep veins, they are the veins that carry blood back from the legs up towards the heart. So if blood clot is formed there, it can stay in place and cause swelling and inflammation and blockage to the circulation of your legs, or it can move and wind up in your heart, or it can wind up in your lungs. So deep venous thromboses are dangerous. Then the other thing you can get is called a PE, or a pulmonary embolism. Pulmonary embolism is, as I said, you get a blood clot somewhere and it's blocking a tube of breathing. So as we said, an embolism is anything. Embolism doesn't have to be a clot. An embolism can be if you do something crazy, like inject peanut butter into your blood, then it will cause an embolism. Also, another common way to get an embolism is an air embolism, where if you have an injury where your pleura is breached and you get air coming out of a space in your breathing apparatus and goes into your blood, you can get an air embolism. So what we see with COVID is we see thromboembolism. So they're usually DVTs or PEs. And the other thing that we see is blood clots forming in the brain. And so it's blocking the circulation of the brain and causing strokes. So patients who are already compromised, because the virus is attaching itself to those ACE2 receptors in the lungs. So when it attaches to the ACE2 receptors, it causes alveolar failure, which is the small air sacs of the lungs where you do your gas exchange. And with the increased risk of blood clots, patients are more at risk for the pulmonary embolisms, which further aggravates their hypoxia. And we know that one of the things we see with COVID-19 is that it causes a reduction in oxygenation to the whole body. With the increased risk of blood clots, patients are at risk for pulmonary embolism, aggravating their hypoxia, and even blood clots traveling to the brain and causing stroke. And from my readings, it seems that the blood clots are caused by elevation in inflammatory cytokines caused by the virus. So what we see is the incidence, I don't have a particular statistic on the rate of blood clots that people are seeing, but ER doctors are definitely reporting them. And so the incidence seems to be fairly low, but they are occurring. And one of the things that's not clear is it's simply because of the nature of COVID that seems to cause this intense cytokine storm. Certainly when you have a cytokine storm, when you have more inflammatory compounds in your blood, you are more likely to have clots. So these cytokines definitely can cause increased coagulability. That is, you're going to be more likely to have blood clots in your in general if you have increased cytokines. When you're inflamed anyway, when you're inflamed for any reason, you're going to be more likely to have blood clots. What we're not clear about is, do people who are getting this increased rate of thromboembolism, do they also have factors that are increasing their likelihood to get them? So, for example, do they have factor V laden? Factor V laden is something that causes increased clotting. It's a genetic predisposition to increased clotting. If you have some level of MTHFR, so particularly if you have the C677T version of the MTHFR gene, which is methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase, you might have a more difficult time reducing homocysteine in your body. Homocysteine is supposed to be in a pathway where it gets converted to cysteine and cystathionine, and then finally gets converted to glutathione, which is a detoxifying, sulfur-bearing amino acid. And if you don't have enough folic acid or B12, you might be at risk for having increased homocysteine, which can increase your risk of clots. And so what we don't know is, are these people being checked for these things? Of course, when you're in an emergency situation, what they're going to be doing is they're going to be, trying to stabilize you. So they're not necessarily going to be doing genetic testing to see if somebody has MTHFR anomalies or if they have factor V laden. And yet, knowing that information would be good. Is this happening? Because I would like to know, is it happening with people who have increased risk of clotting, or is it happening with anybody regardless of their clot risk? That's important to know. So what is going on? Right now, when patients are admitted to the hospital for COVID-19, they're increasingly routinely being injected with blood thinners, such as low molecular weight heparin, that when they get into the hospital, that right away they're putting them on blood thinners prophylactically. And because doctors are concerned about this increased risk of clotting. And what they're seeing is amazing. When the doctors are trying to go for the clots, unfortunately, they'll go in to actually remove the clots, and then they'll see that more clots are forming just as they're removing another clot. That this situation, the cytokine storm, makes you really hypercoagulable, so clots just keep forming, and it's very dangerous. So people are having strokes, people are having DVTs, people are having pulmonary embolisms. As I said, the incidence is relatively rare, and yet because doctors are seeing it a lot, they are doing prophylactic heparin. So if you're not at the level that you're in the hospital, or if you're just quarantining because you're trying to reduce the spread, it's a good idea to keep your blood thin in healthful ways. And how do you keep your blood flowing? The first way is to get exercise. Getting exercise is a good way to keep your blood flowing. Doesn't that make sense?
Well, that makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah. So if you have a lot of circulation going, when you get exercise, you're going to increase the circulation. One of the reasons, another reason that's proposed because the reason why people are getting blood clots, you could have a perfect storm of a cytokine storm, a genetic anomaly that makes you more predisposed to blood clots, and the fact that you're immobile. And the other thing about immobility, if you are unfortunate enough to be put on the ventilator, then you're absolutely immobile. In fact, they put you on paralytic so that you don't move, so that you can't tear the tube out of your lungs. And so the immobility combined with the predisposition, combined with the increased inflammation, increases the risk of clots. So if you're home and we don't know if or who or how far and wide the COVID will be spread, is the idea that it's going to burn out, or is it the idea that we're all eventually going to get it anyway? And those who are fortunate enough to fight it off will fight it off. I'm not sure what the end game is here.
Yeah, what's the deal with that anyway? Are we all going to catch this thing?
I don't know.
Is that what's going to happen?
I don't know. I don't know if, because the idea of stopping the spread, of flattening the curve, is not that the virus goes away. It's that now we have a hospital bed for you.
Right. That was the whole point, right? Was to slow it down enough so that it wouldn't be a
So that sounds like the presumption is that we're all going to get it. That's the presumption. Hmm. I don't know if that's true. The other thing that I'm seeing is that statistically, most people get mild disease or are asymptomatic. But the people who get really sick get really sick. They get sicker than we seem to see with influenza. As we tend to compare this to influenza, we seem to see this as more life-threatening because we see the things like the blood clots. And we see the incredible damage to the lungs, because when those viruses get going and they push their spike proteins into the ACE2 inhibitors in your lungs, it's more dangerous. And that's not something we generally see with influenza. It just seems to happen very quickly and very fast. And it is possible that it's because... That is because this is a novel virus and our bodies just don't have a genetic background to go after it. We don't generally have antibodies for it. So, again, anything that I tell you, if I give you advice on how to fight coronavirus or help to keep yourself healthy, there is nothing that is 100% certain to get rid of coronavirus. So there's nothing that I can say to you to say that you're absolutely not going to get this. I cannot say that to you. And the things that we're using and the things that doctors do when people are in the hospital, they do things that make sense. So you know how, there's controversy around, for example, hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin and remdesivir. All of those things are being used, whether or not the studies are out. If doctors can get their hands on them, they're using things just to help people, just to see what works. Because medicine isn't always a use of what has been double-blind placebo-controlled studied. It's the use of what's on hand and what makes sense. And so with natural medicine, that's a lot of what we're doing as well. We're using things that scientifically make sense in this setting. So one of the things we can tell you at home to keep your blood flowing would be, of course, to get exercise. Another thing to keep your blood flowing is very simply to drink lots of water. That's a very simple way to keep your blood thinner, to have more liquid volume in your blood. If you keep your, and we know that hydration works to increase your blood volume. So, and the more blood volume you have, if you have inflammatory compounds in your blood, the more dilute they will be. The more dilute they are, the less likely you are to clot and the less coagulable you'll be. Hydration helps to protect you from hypercoagulability. All right. So, it's also a good idea to eat lots of produce. You know, that thing that they're not running out of in the supermarket? Fruits and vegetables are very good for you, and they are generally hypocoagulable. They have antiplatelet aggregators in them. There are many basic phytonutrients. The basic phytonutrients that are antiplatelet aggregating, magnesium is an antiplatelet aggregator. So if you eat your leafy greens, you're going to reduce platelet aggregation. And I know some of you are going to say, yeah, but aren't leafy greens high in vitamin K, vitamin K1 in particular, which is part of your clotting cascade? Yes, they are. But they're balanced with phytonutrients, and leafy greens contain essential fatty acids, which tend to thin your blood. They contain magnesium, they contain vitamin C, they contain carotenoids, all of which tend to reduce platelet aggregation. The more produce you tend to eat, the less inflamed you're going to tend to be. So it's a good idea to eat produce, whatever fruits and vegetables you can eat, but particularly make sure you're getting in your leafy greens. One of the things that the coronavirus does is it attaches to hemoglobin and renders the hemoglobin ineffective in doing gas exchange and picking up and releasing iron, so that it makes it harder for you to keep your oxygen on board that way. And so if you eat more leafy greens, you're going to get more chlorophyll on board. And that way your body is more able to reproduce hemoglobin. So it has damaged hemoglobin from COVID attacking it. You're going to be able to make more, and you'll have more substance in which to make more, because chlorophyll has the same heme ring that hemoglobin has. Essential fatty acids. So this is a good time to get your fish oil on board, and lots of essential fatty acids. If you're not into fish, I'm a big fan of fish oil because it does have PGE1 and PGE3 series prostaglandins, which are anti-inflammatory, and fish oil is known to be anti-platelet aggregating. In fact, I have some people who have to back off on their dose of fish oil because it makes them bleed too much. So if you get to that point where you're taking too much anti-platelet aggregation, is it a good idea to take it? You may have to look at how much fish oil you're taking and reduce your dose. However, if you're taking some and you're not particularly having problems with clotting or with bruising, then go ahead and take it. Vitamin C. So you can take vitamin C in pills, and you can also get your vitamin C from all kinds of produce. Kiwi fruit and strawberries are two of my favorites these days, but you can also eat citrus. The only issue with citrus is citrus, of course, is not going to be local. And I think we're past the season in Florida even, so any citrus you get is going to be coming from California, or it could be coming from overseas. So it's a nice idea to look at berries and kiwi fruit. With kiwi fruit are going to be shipped as well, but they'll generally be coming from California, not necessarily overseas. Berries are going to be coming in season soon. Next month, really, you'll start seeing local strawberries. And then eventually you'll see blueberries, blackberries, and raspberries that are relatively local. But they're not out yet. Cocoa polyphenols or cocoa flavanols are antiplatelet aggregators. So when I say cocoa, you're looking at, if you're eating dark chocolate, you want the dark chocolate to be at least 70% cocoa and not too much sugar. It's probably better to get cocoa nibs or toasted cocoa beans and eat those, unsweetened cocoa nibs and cocoa beans. And then you can add them to your food. You can add them to fruit. You can sprinkle them on any food that they taste good on. You can make yourself a bowl of fruit chopped up, make yourself a fruit salad, and add cocoa nibs to it. And you want the cocoa nibs to be just 100% cocoa with no sugar added. And then you're going to get your cocoa flavanols that way. You can also get organic unsweetened cocoa powder and add that to smoothies. You can even put it in applesauce. I think it tastes really good that way. And that's a great way to get it in.
That's your morning little thing that you put together, right?
Well, no, not morning, but yeah, I do put that together. Yeah. I have an applesauce program that I do, because applesauce and apple butter, if you have to put some kind of a medicine that you're not crazy about its taste, apple sauce and apple butter can be great ways to mask it. And I like to make apple butter because I like to take, collagen peptides, and collagen peptides taste, the collagen peptides that I used to get them flavored with lemon, lime, or green apple, but now I get them, without any flavoring, and then they taste okay. And if I put them in applesauce, I can't taste them. So my applesauce has the collagen peptides. I also put glycine in, which is a lovely pain-reducing, calming neurotransmitter that can also help with cramping, with leg cramps and other kinds of cramping. And I also put L-citrulline in because I'm trying to help my blood pressure. And if you're trying to increase your arginine levels so that you have more, and by the way, this L-citrulline might be a great thing for circulation to protect you in terms of COVID, because the L-citrulline converts to arginine, which is a nitric oxide enhancer, which improves circulation in all kinds of ways. So any of, when you're eating produce, by the way, you're going to have more nitric oxide activity, again, which improves your circulation. So we're talking about things to help with platelet aggregation that we want to calm down. Grape polyphenols like resveratrol. Resveratrol is both a cytokine calmer, and so it calms the inflammatory response to COVID, and it also is a platelet antiplatelet aggregator. So you can eat grapes. If you're getting grapes, it's better to get grapes that are from the U.S. If you're getting grapes that are not organic, they could be heavily sprayed. So make sure you wash them well with a produce wash or some kind of a gentle soap. You can use, a gentle castor oil based soap. Just wash them well when you're done so you're not eating the soap to get any pesticides off. Green tea polyphenols. So you can get green tea in pills and you can drink green tea. If you want to get enough green tea on board to make a difference, you probably are going to have to take a supplement because you want to get enough EGCG to really do antiplatelet aggregation and improve your immune system. You might have to take a supplement. If you don't want to take a supplement and you do want to have green tea, then probably the best way to do it is to consume matcha. Matcha is powdered green tea. And you're going to get more polyphenols that way if you're consuming the powder as opposed to dipping a tea bag into hot water. You will get some EGCG that way, but you're going to get a lot more by consuming matcha. Curcumin is my buddy. I love my curcumin. Curcumin is extract of turmeric, and curcumin is a cytokine calmer. So it calms the levels of inflammatory compounds you have in your body. And it also reduces platelet aggregation. Berberines are another one. Berberines reduce platelet aggregation, are calming to your body, and may have some antiviral activity as well. Magnolia and Dong Quai are two Chinese herbs that can be used that are known to be antiplatelet aggregators. And for your immune system, Chinese skullcap, so it's scutellaria bicalensis, which is different from the skullcap that you use as a nervine, calming to the nerves. Ginger and garlic, two of my favorites. I know that one of the things people are saying, eating garlic won't protect you from COVID. Well, maybe it will and maybe it won't. So saying not to eat the garlic, I don't think is a good idea because garlic is a great antiplatelet aggregator. In fact, I have seen people have to cut back on their garlic consumption once again, like they have had to do that with fish oil because it definitely works as a blood thinner. So if you can eat garlic, if you're lucky, unlike me, I can't eat garlic because I get a bad stomach from it, then eat garlic, make your pesto, have garlic in your stir fries and season your food with garlic. And you can get concentrated garlic in pills. And garlic is definitely a good antiplatelet aggregator. Ginger is a favorite of mine. Ginger I can actually eat. I don't have the problem I do with the alliums, with the ginger, with onions and garlic and chives and all of those that I have to eat. I can only eat them if they're cooked to death, and sometimes I can't eat them at all. But ginger is lovely because it's a great anti-inflammatory. It is antiplatelet aggregating, and it does calm cytokines. And another one is frankincense. So a lot of the folks who are interested in essential oils are excited about frankincense. And frankincense definitely is used. We don't only use it as an essential oil, but we use it in supplements. And one of the ways that we've been using it is in phytosome form. We're attaching it to phosphatidylcholine so it's more readily absorbed into the body. It is helpful as an antiplatelet aggregator and a cytokine calmer. So these are things to be focusing on. If you're not big on supplements, just eat lots of fruits and vegetables, big salads, big stir fries, soups with lots of vegetables in them, lots of leafy greens. This is the time to go and support your local farmers markets. And there's lots of lovely farmers markets around. I'm so grateful that the Storrs Farmers Market is all year. And right now they're up to weekly. They're in front of Town Hall. They're nicely spaced out and everybody respectfully wears masks and physically distances while they're in line for the different vendors. And the vendors have enhanced cleaning and ways of giving you what you're buying. And they're doing the best they can to keep it safe for you. And You might just show up at the store's farmer's market and see somebody dressed like they used to dress in the plague. And one of
We saw some funny masks a couple days ago.
Somebody was in a classic plague outfit. And if you don't know what a plague outfit is, what they do is they'll have special goggles with red glass in them, because red glass was thought to protect you from the plague. Not sure why. But they also, the mask that they would wear was in the shape of a long bird's beak. And, you know, that long beak gives you more breathing room. But there's another reason why the bird's beak was shaped like that, is because they put antimicrobial herbs in it.
Did they really?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was just to keep people away from you. I thought that's what it was all about.
So when so the folks who are interested in aromatherapy, there's a blend of herbs, essential oils called Thieves. And it's called Thieves because it's a blend that was used during the time of the plague. When you say plague, you're talking about the bubonic plague, Yersinia pestis, which was spread by rats. And really? What would happen? Oh, yes. So what rats would do is the rats had fleas on them, and the fleas would drink the blood of the rats, because the rats carry the Yersinia pestis. And so the fleas would drink their blood, and then they would bite people, and then they would get the bubonic plague. And it was really deadly. And you would get these lesions on your body called buboes, and they would break open and bleed and fester. And so the idea was that they had the essential oils called Thieves, which supposedly protected the thieves. And the thieves were people who would go around, they would go around pillaging and stealing from people who had collapsed and died of the bubonic plague. And, you know, they would steal their riches, and they would be okay because they were using this thieves oil. So that's interesting. So presumably the big mask with the long beak, they're putting herbs in it that have those essential oils that are supposed to be antimicrobial.
That's great.
All right. So I have a concern that in the mainstream media, there's information discouraging the use of natural medicines to fight the coronavirus or to keep yourself healthy. And as I keep saying, there is no drug approved that is known to consistently fight the coronavirus. None of the compounds I've mentioned, no drug approved that is known to consistently fight the coronavirus. So we have to use the best knowledge that we have on how the virus works and apply what we know about the compounds we have. None of the herbal compounds I mentioned are known to definitely fight the coronavirus. There was information circulating about how garlic can kill the coronavirus, but that it's not proven. That's right. It's not proven. But that doesn't mean don't eat it. It's a great general antimicrobial, and it definitely is an antiplatelet aggregator. So it may make you less likely to clot. But some people take the approach that if it's not proven, you shouldn't take it or go near it. This is why you need someone who knows about natural medicine to use their knowledge about how our tools work to give you educated information that will help you with your health at this time. They're also telling people that nasal lavage, cleaning out your nose or your throat, is not proven to prevent or treat this illness. That's right, because again, it hasn't been studied, but it does make sense. Right now in natural and conventional medicine, all we've got right now is the use of information that makes sense. And
keeping your immune system up and running and, you know, in really, really good shape is really the best battle that you can have against this, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's just, it's on time delay. Don't worry.
Thank you. All right. So let's talk about hydroxychloroquine plus azithromycin. All of the studies done were not rigorous, had improper control groups, and had confounding factors among the participants. So that's why people are not using it. So I have a Medscape article here. There was a small open label study of hydroxychloroquine in France that included azithromycin in 6 patients, which is not a lot, for potential bacterial superinfection. They would give 500 milligrams once, then 250 milligrams orally for 4 days. And these patients were reported to have 100% clearance of SARS-CoV-2. And this is intriguing, but it's only 6 people, and it's not placebo-controlled. The patients receiving combination therapy had initially lower viral loads, and when compared with patients receiving hydroxychloroquine alone with similar viral burden, the results are fairly similar. So the French researchers continued the practice of using hydroxychloroquine plus azithromycin and accumulated data in 80 patients with at least 6 days of follow-up, and noted that 6 patients enrolled in their first analysis were also included in the present case series with a longer follow-up. But it wasn't clear from the description in the posted methods when patients were assessed. A favorable outcome was defined as not requiring aggressive oxygen therapy or transfer to the ICU after 3 days of treatment. 65 of the 80 patients, that's 81.3%, met the outcome. And one patient who was 86 years old died, and a 74-year-old patient also remained in the ICU. And a couple of others were transferred to the ICU and then back to the infection ward. And results showed a decrease in nasopharyngeal viral load tested by PCR, polymerase chain reaction testing, which is how you test for viral DNA and RNA. 83% were negative at day 7 and 93 at day 8. Virus culture results from the patient respiratory samples were negative in 97.5% of patients at day 5. And this is described as a promising method of reducing spread of SARS-CoV-2. But unfortunately, the study didn't have a control group and did not compare treatment with hydroxychloroquine plus azithromycin to a similar group of patients receiving no drug therapy or hydroxychloroquine alone. And the acuity of these patients was low and had 92% score on the early warning system to assess clinical deterioration, and only 15% are febrile. So what this is saying is they did the study. There wasn't a control group. The patients generally did well. Unfortunately, And the thing is, they didn't progress to serious disease, but but as we said, we don't have a control group. So, so because we don't have a control group, we don't know if these patients would have gotten better anyway. That's the hard thing. And yet we had no incidence of people progressing to serious disease. So when you have a situation like this, do you throw the hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin at them? Or do you not? And the other problem you have is when you do a double-blind placebo-controlled study, when you have a situation where people are gravely ill, there's an ethical issue with not giving the drug. So if the drug has a possibility of working, and you see that in an uncontrolled study, that everybody who took the hydroxychloroquine and the azithromycin did well, do you want to be in the control group and not be receiving the drug? You're the one who's receiving the sugar pill. Mm. So there's an ethical issue with that.
Yeah.
Right. Because you could be in the study and not be receiving the drug. And
I
yet,
need it.
Right. Well, you don't. The thing is, you don't know. Problem is when you give the drug and you don't have a control group that doesn't get the drug, you don't know if it worked. You don't know if it was because of the hydroxychloroquine or the azithromycin combination, or did they just get better on their own? But because it makes sense to use it, you might choose to use it anyway. And I'm telling you, that is what doctors are doing. So if you go in the hospital and you have serious disease and you're having trouble breathing and stuff, you might receive hydroxychloroquine. You might receive hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, and you will probably receive heparin to prevent you from clotting, even though there's a low risk of clotting, and yet they're concerned about it enough that you're probably going to get a heparin drip anyway. So let's talk about remdesivir for a minute. So remdesivir is this drug that's showing promise, and it's directly antiviral. This is not a cytokine because hydroxychloroquine is likely, it has some interesting mechanisms. The hydroxychloroquine works by calming cytokines, and it also works by opening up the endosomes inside the cells, these little organs inside the cells, so that the virus can't attach. And so if there's no place for the virus to attach, it doesn't go anywhere, it can't replicate, and so the immune system can get to it and it can die. And then you're just going to stop having viral replication because there's no place for it to attach, and the immune system will go after it, and then you won't have the illness anymore. So that's how one of the mechanisms by which hydroxychloroquine is thought to work. Azithromycin is thought to have some antiviral activity, even though it's an antibiotic. And one of the ways it's almost certainly working is it's calming and quelling superimposed bacterial infections. But there seems to be some direct antiviral activity as well. And so if you're getting that Z-Pak for your bronchitis, it might not be the worst thing. We don't know 100%, but, you know. So I want to say a shout out to the people who are listening. Hi, Cousin Suzanne in Florida. I hope you're doing well. Say hi to everybody in Florida, to all my other cousins and my aunts and uncles and stuff. Hi, Sharon. Thanks for listening. And hi, Mamo. It's lovely to have you listening as well.
Just checked in, yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. So anyway,
Stacy Fulton just.
Hi, Stacy. So anyway, remdesivir, which is an antiviral drug, is still being studied. They are doing double-blind placebo-controlled studies. And again, there's been difficulty in conducting rigorous studies in terms of enrollment criteria and meeting benchmarks for recovery. But remdesivir is something that actually goes and into the cells and helps to prevent viral replication. So it's a little different than, say, your hydroxychloroquine, your azithromycin, and other drugs that are being used. All right. So then we have some, I wanted to address, the CDC put out some coronavirus disease mythbusters advice for the public. Mm. So once again, I wanted to remind you, the first myth they said is that there's no proof, as I said, that hydroxychloroquine or any other drug can cure or prevent COVID-19. And hydroxychloroquine can be misused and can cause serious side effects. So that's the thing. If you're in the hospital and you're getting hydroxychloroquine, somebody is monitoring you and they're watching you for side effects, and they're going to use it in a proven and safe way. If you're just getting hydroxychloroquine from your friend who has an autoimmune condition, you shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't be taking it preventatively. So here, adding pepper to your soup or other meals does not prevent or cure COVID-19. That's interesting. Hot pepper in your food, though tasty, can't prevent or cure COVID-19. And so that's interesting that I hadn't heard that people were actually using that.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that one either.
Again, it is a nitric oxide, and it's not a bad thing to use. Again, not proven to cure coronavirus. As I said, nothing is. But hot pepper, capsaicin and cayenne pepper is a nitric oxide enhancer. Again, anything that enhances nitric oxide can improve your circulation. So in terms of the circulatory problems related to hot pepper, it might be helpful in that way. It's not a bad thing to have in your diet. People are concerned that it's transmitted through houseflies. I didn't know
houseflies?
That.
Houseflies?
Yeah.
What?
Right, because they're just thinking, I don't know. Oh, I guess because
they could land on a surface.
And land on you.
And then land on you.
But supposedly that's not a thing.
Okay.
So it's just not something you need to be worried about. Having said that, if you have flies in your house, you might want to do something about that. Like open the windows, swat them, get some fly paper. We usually have a time of year where where we have to get fly paper because there's too many flies in the house. And it's usually when they manure the fields. And we live near fields that they manure.
Yeah,
they
do.
And the flies come in.
Yeah.
And we have a fly season. And then it seems to calm down.
Yeah.
I don't know if we're not there yet or it's calmer this year.
I've seen a few. They're around.
Definitely.
All the bugs are coming out.
We have not escaped ant season.
No.
Okay, let's talk about disinfectant in your body. Poor Donald Trump. Yeah.
You know, it's unfortunate when he
said some kind of disinfectant, almost a cleaning in the lungs. And he didn't say spray Lysol in your lungs, and he didn't say spray bleach in your lungs. And yet, what he didn't think about was that people listening might interpret it that way.
Right.
And apparently people did. At least some people called poison control before trying it.
Yeah, their poison control lines were lit up.
But I'm not sure if people actually used it. But I would say, in terms of disinfecting the lungs, it might not be a bad idea to vaporize some antimicrobial essential oils. Again, this is not proven. It's just something that makes sense. So you could use nasal sprays that contain oregano oil. You could vaporize oregano oil and or tea tree oil or sage, and you can actually burn sage in your house. Sage has actually been shown to be antimicrobial. So if you have a smudge stick and you want to go burn it through your house, it's not necessarily, although there's probably a spiritual component to it, and I don't want to downplay that there could be a spiritual component to what's going on with the divas of the plant. But if you're talking pure science, There are essential oils in sage that are antimicrobial. So if you burn sage in your house, it may kill some viruses and bacteria. So not a bad idea. But inhaling Lysol or other disinfectants or bleach, not a good idea. Would not recommend it. CDC doesn't recommend it either. So I recommend that you don't do it. Drinking methanol, ethanol, or bleach does not prevent or cure COVID-19 and can be extremely dangerous.
No kidding.
So methanol and bleach are absolute poisons. Ethanol, if you drink enough, it is a poison. By the way, if you don't know this, ethanol is the form of alcohol that's in your beer, in your wine, in your bourbon.
And your gas tank.
And your there is ethanol in your gas tank, that's right. But you do realize that ethanol is a discrete compound.
Mm-hmm.
It's alcohol that, so the definition of alcohol is a generic term for an organic compound that has a hydroxyl group at the end of it. So methyl alcohol has one carbon in it. It has a methyl group, CH3, and because carbon has four spots for other stuff to bond. Methyl alcohol or methanol has three hydrogens bonded to it and one hydroxyl group. So now you have methyl alcohol. Ethyl alcohol or ethanol has two hydroxyl groups. So it has one CH3, three hydrogens, and one more bond to the next carbon. So now it's that's CH2 because one is bond to carbon, one is bond to the hydroxyl group, and two bond to the hydrogens. So that's ethyl alcohol or ethanol. And it's in small amounts, we consume it. In small amounts, we make it in our bodies. You have bacterial, sure, you have bacterial and fungal fermentation that goes on inside your bodies all the time. You're going to get a little bit of ethanol.
Right.
Yeah, and you're good, for sure. Right. So drinking a lot is not going to kill the coronavirus. And drinking a lot of alcohol, you know, whether it's beer, wine, spirits, or whatever. People are drinking more during the pandemic, and people who have problems with alcohol are drinking more during the pandemic, and people who are drinking more in general during the pandemic because they're home, they're not sure what to do, they're upset, and, you know, I'm having to talk to patients about their alcohol consumption, and, you know, you can't say, all right, quit drinking now. You have to talk to them about, all right, how much is too much? Can you back off a little bit? Just be aware of what you're doing. And you can't tell people to stop drinking right now because it's a thing that's keeping people, to some extent, is keeping them sane. So I'm not going to tell people to completely stop drinking right now. I'm going to say, have a little bit of wine and have it in the context of all of your fruits and vegetables and leafy greens and not too much sugar and reasonable amounts of clean protein. And eat healthy food and have a little bit of wine or spirits or whatever your thing is. Those compounds, however, can kill microorganisms on surfaces. So ethanol is what's mostly in your hand sanitizer. If you buy hand sanitizer, it's mostly ethanol. Sometimes it has isopropyl alcohol in it, but it's mostly ethanol. And they're in cleaning products to kill the virus on surfaces. You shouldn't ingest them. And they could theoretically kill the virus in your body, but they're poisonous, so don't do it. So if you disinfect objects and surfaces, you're less likely to touch something, put what you touch to your face, and contract the virus that way. Oh, my goodness.
What?
5G mobile networks.
What about them?
Some people think they spread COVID-19.
You know, I read that. I can't believe it. Well, anyway, I can believe, because someone at HUS told you this, the engineer, I think, there said something about we're in a grand experiment.
We're in a grand experiment with EMFs.
With electromagnetic
fields.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So,
but
therefore,
it doesn't cause coronavirus.
COVID-19
is caused by the coronavirus. It's not caused by 5G waves. Now, there could be something to be said for electromagnetic fields reducing immunity. That I could believe. Again, that's something that needs to be studied. We know that there are some cases where people who live near power lines are more likely to have blood dyscrasias, disorders in their blood, like leukemias and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And even that, you have to live really close to them and have a high level of electromagnetic waves close to you. and it doesn't always happen. And so anyway, 5G networks are not going to do this to you. Are 5G networks good for you in terms of your immune system? That I cannot speak to. Again, our friend John Zatowski said we are in a grand experiment mm-hmm. when it comes to our presence in the ubiquitous electromagnetic fields. So, all right. Exposing yourself to the sun or temperatures higher than 25 degrees C, which is 25 degrees C is in the 70s. Could you look up for me 25 degrees C, what it is in Fahrenheit?
Sure.
Yeah, it's in the 70s, and I can't remember, because, you know, when I have my Canada brain on, I go, woo, it's 25 degrees out today. It's going to be a nice day. Probably wear a short sleeve and maybe a light jacket, but maybe not, believe it or not. Whereas 25 degrees F, you're like, all right, it's freezing. It's cold. I have to bundle up or I'm going to stay inside. It's really interesting how that works. You get excited when you're in Canada and you hear 25 degrees. You're like, yes, let's go outside. Sounds great.
25 C is 77.
77. So it's a really right. nice day.
Yeah.
So getting outside. So if we, yesterday, according to this, we killed a bunch of coronavirus.
Yeah,
because we were out. It was actually over 77 degrees here. I think it might have gotten up to 80 yesterday. It was really lovely yesterday.
It was.
And right now it's pushing 70, and they said it was only going to get up to the 60s. So I want to get done with this so I can get outside. Anyway, so the sun all by itself isn't going to protect you from getting COVID-19. The way you catch it is you touch a surface, you touch your face, and it gets into your respiratory passages. However, so the whole idea was that ultraviolet light is known to kill the virus. It's thought to kill the virus, but that's if the virus is by itself sitting outside. It still doesn't mean that you can't take all the precautions. It doesn't mean that if you go outside, you're going to cure yourself of coronavirus. Right. I do think there's something to be said for if you go outside, you may be somewhat less likely to catch it, because being in the sun does help to improve your immunity. It's going to help your sleep-wake cycle. It's going to help your melatonin cycle. And if you have adequate melatonin, that does improve your immune system. You are going to make more vitamin D getting outside, and thyroid hormone and serotonin, which is going to help your immune system and help you sleep. So the sun does indirectly help your immune system in general, which may help you to get less serious disease. But it's not going to fight the virus directly by shooting if you're sick already. It's by shooting electroviolet or an ultraviolet light on you isn't going to take the virus away. It doesn't make sense. You can recover from COVID-19, and catching the new coronavirus does not mean you will have it for life. In other words, if you get sick with coronavirus and you recover, theoretically you're done with it. I guess there's some thought that once you have it, that it hides in your body and you always have it. And then there are people who are concerned that there are sequelae. So what we're not clear about there is, so people recover from it and then they come down with symptoms again. Does that mean they have relapsed and the virus has not been completely cleared from their body? We do know that there are at least two strains of this coronavirus. And so could you catch one and then catch the other? That is a possibility. And so it may just be that, you know, the virus has not been completely cleared from your body, and that's why you tend to relapse. But if you recover completely, the thought is that you're done, that with at least with this coronavirus. Can you catch it again? We don't know.
That's going to depend on
how much this coronavirus mutates. Also, we know that when you are done with the coronavirus, you're going to have IgG antibodies, and those are your antibodies that are going to fight the virus if it comes back in. Are those antibodies going to persist for life? We don't know.
Yeah.
That's something that's going to have to be studied. So, and by the way, I'll let you know that I actually had myself tested, and I was tested by a company. I wasn't tested by Quest Diagnostics. I was tested by a company that we use to do our food intolerance testing that has a very high level IgG and IgM screening, and I was negative. And so that bronchitis that I had back in February presumably was not coronavirus. So it speaks to, I'm not clear how widespread this thing is, because we know that out here in Mansfield, Connecticut, we have a very low case rate. I caught it, presumably I caught it in Mansfield, the bronchitis I caught, either I caught in Mansfield or I caught from my from my family in New Jersey. I'm not sure. And so, or I could have caught it on the UConn campus. I caught it in town, but I don't have antibodies to it. So I'm assuming that I didn't have it. So it may not be as prevalent out this way. And yet that's not a reason for me to relax. I'm continuing to take my supplements and my antivirals and eat my produce and get my rest and doing my physical distancing and wearing my masks and enhancing cleaning procedures. We're doing all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that whole thing about being able to hold your breath for 10 seconds or more without coughing or feeling discomfort does not mean you're free from the coronavirus. How can that be true when we know that people can have the coronavirus and be asymptomatic? So there is this meme that, or this bit of information going around that you can do this test. If you can hold your breath for 10 seconds or more without coughing or feeling discomfort, you don't have the virus.
Oh, my God.
I would say that means you don't have acute lung distress, but it doesn't mean you don't have the coronavirus, because you can have a very low level of symptoms, and you can have no symptoms. So you can't assume that. You can't make any assumptions.
Because you could present that to someone who has been a heavy smoker or something.
Sure.
They may not be able to do that.
That's right. Well, somebody with COPD may not be able to do it either. So anybody with lung disease of any kind might have that problem. And the other piece is, you can be asymptomatic and have the coronavirus. So, if you're concerned about having it, then you watch out for the symptoms. They said this already, drinking alcohol doesn't protect you against COVID-19, can be dangerous. So we're talking about consumption of alcohol because it's known to be a topical disinfectant. And now we're addressing alcohol consumption directly. Drinking extra wine or beer isn't going to protect you. The only thing is that having a little bit of red wine might be helpful, because the red wine is going to contain resveratrol and it is antiplatelet aggregating. But that doesn't mean it's a cure, and it doesn't mean you should drink half a bottle a day.
But you don't want to overtask your liver.
That's right. That's why it's very concerning that people are drinking excessive alcohol. And we know people are doing it, because there was that research that came out that showed that that alcohol sales were up 55% since the pandemic.
Insanity. Yeah.
Because people are at home, they're bored, they're upset. They want to drink more. It makes them feel good, and something they reach for. And people with addictions are experiencing their addictions more intensely right now because they're upset and they're scared. So it makes sense. The virus can be transmitted in areas with hot and humid climates. There's that thought that, well, it's not flu season anymore. It's not cold and flu season, and you don't tend to get colds and flus when it's hot in the summer. So therefore, it's not easily transmitted. Well, maybe it is. They're saying, because we're seeing disease in places that have hot weather. It remains to be seen, because now we are entering the spring and summer season in the United States. Is the case rate going to go down with the warm weather? It's not clear. There's a combination of the warmer weather coming and the relaxing of some of the physical distancing rules that they're starting to open up certain states. For example, Georgia, they opened up Georgia. And on May, we actually don't know what's going to happen yet in Connecticut, because the date to reopen businesses was set to be May 20th. Right. And we're not 100% clear that that's going to happen.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
But, we'll see. Maybe part of the business. Maybe it'll be a partial business. And it might be parts of the state, depending on the infection.
That's right. Rate. We're going to be the first ones, because we have a very low infection rate out here.
We do.
So cold weather and snow can't kill the new coronavirus. That's silly, because the spikes in cases happen during the winter. So if you think you're going to freeze it out, that doesn't make any sense. So again, temperature is not going to save you. I would say that heating your body up might be helpful. It's not going to be, you can't rely on it, because I generally think that when you heat up your body, it does stimulate circulation. And the reason you get fevers with viruses of any kind is because the body fights infections more easily at higher temperatures, and viruses want your body to be normal body temperature. So with this, there is some idea that heating your body, getting exercise, getting sweaty exercise, taking hot showers and hot baths can be helpful. Hmm. But this is another thing that's generally thought to be effective for helping you with viruses in general, but has not been studied to kill this coronavirus. And the next thing was taking a hot bath does not prevent new coronavirus disease. No, I mean, in order to prevent the coronavirus disease, you have to not be infected with it. That's all there is to it.
Right.
And it's not known to be transmitted through a mosquito bite. It's known to be transmitted through droplets, as we've talked about in the past. So you can get other things through mosquito bites, like West Nile virus, which I don't see a lot.
No, but there's been some talk about, you know, what happens when all this other stuff hits us, because, you know, we had 1 or 2 cases in Connecticut last year, I think, of
West Nile virus. Yeah.
It wasn't, like, heavy at all.
No. Hand dryers are thought to be effective against the coronavirus. No. You have to scrub your hands with, the best thing is soap and water, the second best thing is hand sanitizer. Because soap and water will break through. Soap breaks through the fatty layer on the outside of the virus. Ultraviolet lamps should not be used to disinfect your hands. No, ultraviolet light might be somewhat helpful if you put a sheet outside that has virus on it. It might kill it. But if you want to wash virus off your hands, use soap and water or hand sanitizer. Thermal scanners are effective in detecting people who have a fever. They detect fevers. They don't detect the virus. What detects the virus is PCR testing and antibody testing. Vaccines against pneumonia are not going to protect you. Vaccines against anything else that's not the coronavirus is not going to protect you against the coronavirus. So if you get a flu shot or Haemophilus influenza or any other vaccination, not going to protect you against the coronavirus. So here, the CDC recommends against rinsing your nose with saline and really? Gargling. Yes, because it doesn't work. All right?
Since when?
Yeah, so that's why I'm saying, again, you're right. It hasn't been proven to fight against the coronavirus, but it makes sense. So I say that it's still a good idea.
I think it's a great idea.
When you regularly rinse your nose with saline. And it may help you to recover more quickly. I still say that you should do it. It hasn't been proven to fight it. But if there's virus on board in your nose or in your throat, gargling and rinsing your nose can be helpful.
Right.
But this is one of those things that I say, even though it's not proven, it's still okay to do it. And they're also saying that garlic, there's no evidence that garlic can help you with the coronavirus. Again, that's right. But it does things that we know about. It is a good antimicrobial. It does thin your blood. We're concerned about blood clots. It can help that way. And it also keeps people away from you. People of all ages are susceptible. They are working. Antibiotics are not effective, although they are working. They are studying azithromycin, and they are working on the remdesivir, as we talked about. All right. So I think I talked about everything, so I have to go.
I put you down here.
Yeah. So...
yeah.
So it's been great to talk to you. I still say do go outside because being outside is good for you, and eat fruits and vegetables and wash your hands. So you have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine, although you can't call in right now because we're not in a place where you can do that. I am Fran Storchendi, naturopathic physician with my co-host Ron Meniza. You can also email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back next week with more Radio Naturopath at 91.7 FM. WHUS Stores and WHUS.org.